Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. I am wiped out, and I'm wiped out because I guess everyone wants to come on my show, and they're very, very interesting people, but it's so much work, but it's exciting, and the Celebrity Show, I'm so glad we're doing it now. So I want to welcome the program, Rex McGee. Rex, Celebrity Rex McGee, how are you, Rex?
I am very good tonight.
All right.
Very good.
Fantastic. So tell our audience a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about how you got in your show, how into your showbiz career, and then I'm sure I'll have some questions on the way as well. So first, tell us little bit of your background. Yeah.
Well, I grew up in a little town in North Texas, and my father was a movie projectionist, so I went to the movies with him constantly, and I watched movies over and over again. I could thread a projector when I was 5 years old, and so I got to like movies, and I got to be interested in how they were made, and photography and music, and so I knew very early on in high school that I wanted to make movies. And as soon as I got out of high school, I hit the road to California, and I had gotten into the USC Film School, which is, just George Lucas land.
Yeah.
He had gotten out of there right before that. And so it was a small place in those days, but it was just beaming with talent. And I loved movies. I'd seen old movies, but to be around other people who loved movies as much as I did, just heaven on earth. And because those film schools really didn't exist. There was USC, UCLA, and NYU at that point, and it just wasn't a big thing in those days. And when I got to USC, I mean, all the great directors were alive. So we had people like Orson Welles coming to our classes.
Oh, wow.
And John Ford and George Cukor and Billy Wilder and King Vidor and Frank Capra also. You know, he had the worst wardrobe I've ever seen. Frank Capra did it. It was like red plaid. I'll never forget that. But, and Hitchcock came down one time. He brought a new film he had made, and we got to go back to our professor's house with Hitchcock. And I remember sitting on the floor at his feet like some grandkid, listening to his stories and actually watching him get drunk, too. But it was a magic place in those days, USC was. And so many great people came out of there. Bob Zemeckis, who did Forrest Gump, and he just did Flight. John Carpenter, the horror king. All those guys were running around in those days. Randall Kleiser, who directed Grease.
Wow.
And then it was just an incredible time in the 70s when we were when I was there. And you can learn so much about movies by just watching them. And we would watch. We wouldn't leave the screening room all weekend. We'd bring our food. We'd camp out there, and we'd just watch and watch and watch. And it was just a great experience. And then in my my junior year, I wrote a letter to my idol, who was Billy Wilder, who was famous for Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard,
right.
Somewhat Hot. And Billy, I just wrote this very simple little fan letter. He had made a movie that wasn't doing very well, and I loved it, and just told him so. And I was in my dorm room, and I heard this strange Viennese accent, and he called me up and invited me to come and see him at the studio, at the old Sam Goldwyn studio lot. And I'm floored at this point. I go over, and I'm in this office where I know he at the same place he's written Some Like It Hot in the apartment. And so I remember sitting in a chair. I was 21 years old, and he was pacing up and down in front of me, and he was saying, I don't know, this last film just totally flopped. And he said, I don't know what to do, Rex. Should I keep making movies or write plays or play the horses at Hollywood Park? And I'm sinking in my chair at this point. And I'm Billy Wilder's asking me what I think he should do. It was an amazing day. But A year later, he made a film called The Front Page, which is a remake with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, and he made me his assistant on that picture. And it was a glorious experience. He gave me copies of all his screenplays, and he ran all of his movies for me. And so I could read the script, watch the movie, and then talk to the guy who made it. And it was graduate school from heaven. I do not know how I was so lucky. But anyway, that one little letter changed my life.
Wow,
so,
wow. Really what's interesting, Rex, is, again, right place, right time. I've been seeing it in my career in radio where I somehow said I wanted to do a podcast, and it came from here to this and that, and then before you know it, I'm interviewing interesting people like you every day. And it's like, wow, how things happen, how you connect with one person, and then you just ride that wave and continue. So it did. Once you became his assistant, then you got your big break, right? After that.
Yeah. And then, you know, I saw filmmaking at the top of its game. And he made another film in Europe called Fedora, which I went on with him. And Henry Fonda was in it, and Bill Holden was in it, and Jose Ferrer. And we were on a Greek island for a month, and in Paris, and in Munich. And I even have a little scene with Henry Fonda in the film. And it's actually, Fedora is being restored for Blu-ray right now. And we're going to do a series of interviews about the film.
Wow.
So I'm very pleased at that. He, you know, Billy died 10 years ago, actually. And but I was friends with him for, my gosh, 25 years.
Wow.
And I learned everything I know about the movies from him, and I learned about music and art and food and women, and I mean, it was just whenever I have my students now, I say, if you really admire somebody, write a letter to them.
Yes.
You just never know how it's gonna hit them or what it's gonna do. That the letter I wrote literally changed my life.
And I am such
a grateful guy.
And you took that chance,
I mean,
Rex. Yeah.
I didn't expect anything to come of it. It was a sincere letter, and I meant it. And you just never know.
And that's the key when you say you just never know. And I wanted to talk about this in a lot of ways. For being an education talk show, even though it's celebrities and you're educating us about all your different things, and look forward to hopefully having you on as a monthly guest on the show, because you're really an interesting guy and I learned so much from you, and hopefully be able to reach out and ask you, who should I interview next and where am I going? Because that's so great when artists work together in specific projects and thought process and learn from each other. And that's the key. You wanted to learn from someone. Then you went on and worked with him. And then what was your break where, you know, this is it, you know, he set you up. What would you say your biggest project was that kind of put you on the map? What would you say it was?
Well, you know, after my kind of period of internship with him, I was always writing screenplays, but I wrote a script. I found a story in the L.A. Times, and it was about a group of this was in the days of the Soviet Union, and this story in the L.A. Times told a tale of this roving group of comedians, of political comedians, who literally told jokes and then ran for their lives, because telling a joke against the government could land you in psychiatric prison or worse.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what an amazing idea that a joke could get you killed, you know? And so I researched about the Soviet Union. I researched Soviet humor and the underground humor there. It's like, I guess it was like a Jon Stewart in Soviet Union, you know? They just didn't exist for very long. Because they got put away.
Right, exactly.
And so I researched and I wrote a script, and it was called The Life of the Party, and the Communist Party. And so I got it to an agent at CAA in L.A., and through some friends, and Dustin Hoffman took a liking to it, and suddenly I was a client of the biggest agency in town. And they were trying to sell my script. We never sold that one because you know eventually the Soviet Union fell, and so with that was my script. Who expected the Soviet Union to fall and destroy my script, possibly? But that one breakthrough, opened so many doors for me. Just having Dustin Hoffman like your script was good enough to get everybody's attention. And so I started getting rewrite jobs at Fox. The actress Daryl Hannah took a liking to my work, and so I did a project with her. And then it just mushroomed from there. You build contacts, and people get to know your work. It takes time. But it's just tremendous. The way I've been very lucky, and I'm very grateful. And then I hit the wall. I was there for a few years. I was getting scripts. I was getting jobs. I was making a great living, but nothing of my writing was getting made into movies.
Oh.
And I it was very frustrating. And after a time, if you're a writer in Hollywood, you begin to you begin to go with what's being made out there, and you begin to, lose your own creative voice, because you're trying to move ahead, trying to get your movies made, and you start copying. And so I know I hit the wall, and I took a holiday from Hollywood, and I went back to my old hometown in North Texas, and I was trying to figure out what stories do I want to tell? What sparked me into writing and being in the movies in the first place? And along came this movie project through a producer named Jerry Weintraub, who was famous for being the Carpenters' manager and managed Elvis Presley's later tours. And he had convinced a country singer named George Strait to make a movie, because Elvis's old manager, Colonel Tom Parker, had the idea that you should put George Strait in a movie. And George Strait wasn't sure he wanted to be in the movies. But anyway, I was working, there was a woman working for Weintraub that had worked with me before, and she said, hey, you want to write a movie for George Strait? And I said, who's George Strait? I had no idea who he was at the time, because I was not a follower of country music.
Right.
But she knew I was from Texas, George Strait, okay, you're going to write a movie. And so, my God, I said, what are we going to write? And I remember the producer, Weintraub, said, I hear my directions for this script. He said, it's going to have 10 songs in it, because we got to have a CD. And because George is some sort of rodeo cowboy in real life, he said, the second requirement of this script is that he's got to rope something in the movie. So I had two assignments. He's got to sing 10 songs. He's got to rope something. So I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? So eventually it kind of came back to my own situation. Now, they say write about what you know. Some of the best stories are right in front of you. And so I said, okay, where am I? I was in Hollywood. I burned out. I didn't know what sparked me. I didn't know what moved me anymore. And eventually that became the kind of genesis for Pure Country, the movie that I wound up writing, about a guy, in this case a country western star, who's burned out. He's lost touch with his music, with his passion. And so in the movie story, he goes home to Texas. He disappears from his tour, goes back to his roots, and finds again what moved him, what he loved about music, and he even finds a girl in the bargain. And so that became the story for Pure Country. And it's, in some ways, people have said it's like similar to the old story, The Return of the Prodigal Son,
yes. Mm-hmm.
From the Bible. But it's much deeper than that. This film amazes me because it has such a following. It is still playing. It plays on country music television, CMT, every week. I get calls from people all over the country saying they've named their children after my characters.
Oh, wow.
It's astonishing to me. And
if you wouldn't have went to Texas, that would never have happened.
Right. Right, right. And I think it hits people on some level that we all get to, which is, you know, you get to a certain point in life. I guess they call it a midlife. That's my dog, sorry. it's a midlife crisis, you know, where you've been a success, you've got your family, you're halfway through your life, and you're going, is this all it is? Is this all there is? And
yes.
Like that old Peggy Lee song. And I think that's why it touches so many people, because we all get to that point in our lives. So there's got to be something more.
Right.
You know? And
so, Rex, after Pure Conjury, Rex, did you stay in Texas, or did you ever go back to Hollywood?
I started going back and forth on a regular basis after that, and other jobs came up, and I optioned a book and wrote adapted a novel, a wonderful book called Waltz and Marathon, and that script is still on the shelf. It's my favorite work of all I've ever done, but it was bought. But then the company that bought it went bankrupt and went out of business. So that poor script of mine is sitting there, just waiting to be made. I would love to get it to Robert De Niro and Bradley Cooper, who just did a great movie called Silver Linings Playbook. Loved it.
Oh wow! So so Rex, then what made you want to become a teacher? Because then the next time you come back, I want to talk about being a teacher and how wild that is. And you never probably thought you were going to be that. And your dog never thought you'd be a teacher either, right?
Oh, no, I never thought I'd be a teacher. When I came back to Texas, I was in this little town where I was born. It's called Cleburne. And I was used to being around creative people and writers and directors and actors, and after being in L.A. for so long, and there was nobody in Cleburne I could talk to. So I was just desperate to find artistic colleagues. So I took a class in Dallas, and it was based on Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way, which is about kind of unblocking, you know, learning, helping people be creative. And so I took the class, and the teacher said, do you want to take over the class for me? And this was at SMU, at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And I took over the class, realized that I could teach, that I could share a lot of what I had learned from Billy Wilder and everything about how to be creative. And so I guess I have sort of a knack for it. It's a big surprise to me. I had no idea, but I love it.
Well, it sounds like you love it, and that's the important thing. And from there, you keep keeping your hands into Hollywood. What are the current projects you're working on, Rex?
Well, one of the things I'm most excited about is that we've developed Pure Conjury into a stage musical, and with the original songwriters from the movie, and we've totally revamped the story. It's the same story, but it's a musical now. Everybody sings, not just the George
wow.
Strait character. And the original songwriters they've written 15 new songs for the show, and we have a reading planned in Fort Worth at that famous Casa Manana Theater. The songwriters, John Bettis and Steve Dorff. John Bettis, the lyricist, he started the Carpenters with Richard Carpenters. And so he wrote Yesterday Once More, and he wrote Human Nature for Michael Jackson, and One Moment in Time for Whitney Houston. I mean, just incredible talents here. And so we're looking forward to doing that very soon. I always have a couple of scripts in the works. You know, I'm revisiting a couple. I may revisit that old Soviet Union story. Now it's a period piece. You know, I don't, but you know, I've always got too many stories that are hanging around that I can't get to yet.
Well,
I always think of my scripts as my children, and you know, I wish more of them would leave home. You know, there's a lot of them still living at home. So, you know.
All right, Rex, where can we find more information on you? Look forward to you coming back next month again. More information on you and learn more about you.
All right, sure. I'm so glad, Brad. I'm sorry about my dad.
That's okay.
I'm teaching screenwriting at KD College in Dallas. It's a performing arts conservatory, and I'm getting to share all the stuff that I learned from Billy Wilder to my 18, 19, 20-year-old students, and it's just a great joy that I have to do.
All right.
So it's a great school.
And what do you have a website, Rex, to follow you? Or watch or check you out or Twitter or whatever?
Yes. Well, I just got a website up and going now, and it's rexmcgee.wordpress.com. And it's got a lot of material there and some videos and some scripts and all about more than you wanted to know about Rex McGee, I can guarantee you.
Well, Rex, thanks for calling the program, man. Look forward to having you back next month again, and it was a pleasure. So thanks again for calling.
Sure, Neil. Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. All right, that was Rex McGee. You're listening to the Total Education Celebrity Spotlight Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Spotlight Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Well, so far, unbelievable show. Really enjoying the topics. But I'm interested in this one because I want to get my hands on some Super Bowl tickets. Please, come on now. But I want not just sports Super Bowl tickets. I want backstage passes. Why? Because I want to be at the Super Bowl thing to go and do the interviews and everything. So I think this guy might be able to help me. So I want to welcome to the program Tony Knopp. You are from Sports Ticket Spotlight Ticket Management. Thanks for calling.
I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. And so I guess tell our audience a little bit what you do and then how I can get my hands on some great Super Bowl tickets.
Well, what we do, we manage sports tickets for major corporations. So at every company around the world, we've all had the experience of tickets placing away in drawers and trying to entertain a customer at the last minute, basically trying to give away our baseball tickets at the last minute. What we do is help companies better understand what they're getting for the tickets that they have, better understand what customers are going to the game, what the potential ROI is for those tickets, and just making sure they're not getting thrown in the trash. So that being said, you know, we manage over 5 million tickets for a number of major corporations globally known, and as such, you know, Super Bowl tickets are a big part of that.
So what you're saying is sometimes the tickets that are given out to corporations are never used.
Yeah, actually, more than 4 out of 10 go in the trash can. So the number that we've seen is 43% of all tickets that a company owns, they go totally unused, end up in the trash. And that's a rather large number. There are 125 million tickets globally owned by businesses. So there's a rather large amount of tickets that end up getting wasted, and that's why we've had quite a good demand for our product.
So, Tony, you can get your hands on some big events in Pittsburgh, by the way? Just asking.
We do on occasion. We try to make sure those are getting used appropriately by our customers, and a lot of times they'll invite us, which is probably not the best ROI for them, but it's flattering nonetheless.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so that's basically really an interesting thing because I would never have known. I mean, I guess you see tickets, you see empty seats all the time, and they say they're sold out, so that they end up. And that just really hurts, I get, a corporation's bottom line, especially with this economy, that they're hoping that their clients are going or their customers are going, because if it's wasted money, what a waste when how expensive tickets are nowadays.
Well, it goes beyond all of that as well. So the average company ticket actually that they own is $154 a piece. So companies buy the expensive tickets. They spend more money than you and I do. And when they go out and buy a ticket on StubHub, done what they already own, they spend on average more than $350 per ticket. They're spending a good amount of money, and it's really just an outright waste to see those tickets go to the trash can. You know, they also run into a lot of pressure. It's not really popular right now having banks and financial institutions taking big wigs to sports events and sitting in a suite. I've seen it as a boondoggle, and people regularly like to remind them that, you know, you guys are in charge of money and you're in charge of people's wealth in a time of pain for a lot of people. And most importantly, you know, the teams feel that as well. You know, people don't show up at the game. They don't buy beers. They don't buy merchandise. They don't buy soft drinks. They don't buy hot dogs. And they take a hit as well.
All right, Tony, so now what all our listeners out there are wanting, how can I get my hands on Super Bowl tickets and not mortgage my house?
Well, I think all of us are going to mortgage our house for the Super Bowl. But, it's really interesting how the Super Bowl tickets work. You know, the theory is that everybody knows long in advance where the tickets are and who has them. But in fact, that's not true. They actually don't divvy out the tickets until the last minute for a large chunk of them. For each one of the NFL teams, each one of the 32 teams, they get 1% of the tickets that are in the building. From there, the two losing teams from this weekend's championship games will each get 8.5% of the building.
Wow.
So if the Ravens lose and the 49ers lose, they'll get 8.5% of the building. Now, a lot of times, those are the tickets that end up out there in ticket brokers' hands. As you can assume, you know, the 49ers aren't too fired up about going to the Super Bowl after they just lost in the championship game. The two participating teams can get an additional 17.5% each of the building. So the theory that, you know, I got to buy my tickets a long way in advance or they're going to sell out is not true, as the majority of the tickets are not even out yet until 2 weeks prior to the game.
Wow.
Now, at that point, it becomes a lot shadier, so to speak. The NFL does have tickets that they sell. They sell it through an event brokerage called, they call it NFL On Location. Basically, what they do is they sell tickets at a markup to the public. And other teams have a number of different resources that they can do. Some teams take their customers to the games. Others sell them to brokers. Others sell them to a number of different companies. I've actually seen them do this. It's very accepted. It's something the public doesn't talk about much and the public doesn't love. It happens. But most every team does sell a certain amount of their Super Bowl tickets for a pretty hefty profit.
Wow. And what are they running a face value right now for certain tickets? How much is it?
Right around, you know, the face value for the Super Bowl used to be one of the better deals in sports. I mean, not that long ago, 10 years ago, it was only $300 to the Super Bowl, $250. Now it's around $1,000 face value to get into the game. It was $700 a couple of years ago. And, you know, I'll tell you the good news is it's definitely gotten more efficient. A few years back, you had the face value crowd, which was very difficult to get. And then you had the brokers and the people who are reselling tickets out there. And tickets could go maybe $4,000 just to get in the building. I mean, just for the worst seat in the building. I remember when the Bears played the Colts in Miami, it was that much. And all the way up to $10,000 a seat. And the invention of companies like StubHub and TicketsNow and Ticket Exchange has actually created a more efficient market, which has brought ticket prices down. So it's still very expensive. You're still going to pay $1,000 plus to get in a game. But I think the days of the $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 get in ticket, those are behind us.
Why do you think that's behind us? Because of the economy?
I think it's the economy is one major reason behind it, but I also think it's just the market is more efficient now. You used to not be able to not know where to buy a ticket and be able to buy it. And now almost anybody can go online and find a StubHub or a large ticket broker or a company like that and be able to find tickets for a decent price. You know, for $1,500 versus $4,000 from a guy down the street. Now, you know, the issue there is it's never going to come much further down because even the source, the NFL, they sell tickets for a massive profit and they have no interest in changing them. And their ticket prices change regularly. They change them based on what the market cares. So, you know, the hopes of you and I of a Super Bowl ticket one day being $200 are probably dashed for good.
And unless the Super Bowl loses popularity, which is not the case. Have you been there, Tony? Have you gotten to go to the Super Bowl?
I have been to 8 of the last 10 Super Bowls, yes. I go to a lot of them.
Here's the question. How crazy is it? I mean, this is, again, an important point. Like, I mean, every day.
Of course. You know, there's two Super Bowls. There's the Super Bowl that you and I would experience, which is, you know, if you went on your own. Which is, it's a fun experience. There's the NFL's got a lot of things to do where you go around and see the city and interact with the NFL. Then there's the Super Bowl for the majority of the house, which is corporate customers. And that Super Bowl is much different. That Super Bowl is very high-end parties, ranging anywhere from $1,500 to $4,000 per person to get into, sponsored by Maxim Magazine and you know, Sports Illustrated has the swimsuit models at one of their parties, and there's a Kim Kardashian party and all kinds of different parties. And it's just a 4-day, you know, high-end partying experience where companies are paying, you know, 20 times what they usually pay to stay in a Marriott downtown.
Wow.
And, you know, they go from one swanky event to another. They go to a pregame show that generally features a band, and then they go to a 5.5-hour football game, which you know, it makes for a very different crowd at the Super Bowl. It's certainly not as rowdy as if it was in one of the home seats.
And that's interesting, but I think that, again, it's one of the largest events in the world, and I guess when your clients, they really watch out for, if they're investing $1,500 or even for box seats, probably $10,000, that these tickets are used, especially if you have a terrible matchup for the Super Bowl. And let me give you an example. I wonder what would be the best matchup for the Super Bowl. I mean, my Steelers are out of it. The Broncos are out of it.
Those are actually two very big draws, the Steelers and the Broncos. They're probably two of the top five draws in the AFC as far as Super Bowl pricing goes. But if you talk to any major broker out there, and I know them all, and you talk to Steph, right now, the biggest win for them would be Baltimore and San Francisco.
You're kidding me. Not Green Bay against New England. Is it because it's too many times they played each other in the Super Bowl? Or?
Well, you know, the thing about New England is they've been there too many times recently.
Yes.
So it's no longer a once-in-a-lifetime.
And they're cheaters, too. Yeah, they're cheaters, but okay.
So they've been there a number of times. You look at the San Francisco 49ers, and they haven't been to a Super Bowl in 20-plus years. They have a very young entity, and there's a lot of young money in the Silicon Valley in the area. So they'll travel well, and I believe, and many of the people I talk to believe, that will be a very very well-traveling team. You have somebody like the Baltimore Ravens. They traveled very well in 2000. I don't think they travel anywhere near as well as the Redskins would. But, you know, if we're talking about, you know, the 49ers and the Ravens are the best of what's left. If you're saying who are the best overall in the NFC are the Dallas Cowboys, the San Francisco 49ers, Chicago Bears. And in the AFC, the Denver Broncos travel very well. Pittsburgh Steelers travel fantastically.
The best, right?
Yeah, they actually travel fantastically. They have very committed fans. They have a national fan base, and they do very well. In the NFC, you know, you could put the Packers in there. It generates some corporate interest. They don't have a lot of corporations headquartered in the Milwaukee, Green Bay area, as opposed to, say, a Dallas or a, you know, San Francisco,
right,
where you have a number of people traveling. And Dallas still has a significant fan base in the Houston area. So if you're looking for the biggest games, those are them, right? You get the Dallas Cowboys playing the Denver Broncos, you'll get quite an expensive ticket.
Interesting. So I you would think that the matchup that they want, and that surprises me. So and I think the matchup that we're going to get is New England against Green Bay. I just believe it. I don't know. I just don't think that San Francisco or Baltimore, unless they were going to try to win it for Ray. You know, that's the key. So what would you say? So for the average fan, now I'm an average fan. I want to get a ticket for the Super Bowl. What steps would you provide? Say, go ahead and do.
Sure. Yeah. So what we do, we've been in the industry a long time. We actually don't own any tickets, and we don't broker tickets. We don't tell people you should buy from this or this. What we do is we provide them with all of the options that are safe for them embedded, right? So that when AT&T is buying a ticket, they know they're getting it from somebody that is reputable. Step one is make sure you can get a ticket in your hands more than a week prior to the game. A very common thing with the Super Bowl is for ticket brokers to sell a ticket at a price when they don't yet have it. They're basically speculating on it, thinking, I will sell it to you for $3,000, and I believe I can go get it for $2,000, and you can come pick it up for me before the game. So I would definitely make sure that you can get your ticket in your hands. I would make sure they give you a specific, wherever you're buying a ticket, you get a specific location. There's a lot of people who will give you a range of tickets. They'll be somewhere between these sections, and they have a number of elaborate reasons why they'll say that, mostly that they don't yet have their tickets, and they're assuming that they're going to get allotment there, and that's a good way for you to get burned. Thirdly, you know, like most other things, you get what you pay for. You're much better off using a very large, very well-renowned shop like the NFL's Ticket Exchange or StubHub or the NFL's On Location program. They have the backing that if in some way there was fraud, which, you know, usually there's not. Let's say, you know, you buy a ticket and you get to the gate, you don't get in. They have the money, the resources, and the people on the ground to get you in.
Wow.
So that's definitely one of the more important things. And then what I'd say, and we're past that point now, is don't buy the ticket too early and get duped by people trying to tell you that they're going to run out. That's just simply not.
Interesting. Very interesting conversation. I was educated very well by you, Tony, and I think that what you guys do is interesting, but I think just to know that it's that easy for a Super Bowl ticket, I'm sure probably the ticket's the cheapest thing of going to the city for the Super Bowl because of how much it costs for a hotel, how much it probably costs for parking, how much the food is raised for that weekend. It's got to be just an enormous amount of money. I want to cover one at one point during the press to kind of interview the players that have foundations and charities. I just don't know how to get a press pass for it. I know it's a pretty challenging thing, but if my network keeps growing, I might have the opportunity. So, Tony, where can we find more information on you and learn more about what you do?
You can check us out anytime at spotlighttms.com. It's that Spotlight Ticket Management System.com. We're all over the internet. And, you know, it's been growing very rapidly. It's humbling, and we're definitely very proud of the team we have. We've got some great people around us that allowed us to grow exponentially and allowed us to partner with, you know, and we've partnered with 16 NFL teams. We've partnered with 52 teams in total across the four major leagues. And, you know, we're honored that they have us out to the Super Bowl, and we get an opportunity to see those things. It's certainly not lost on us.
Well, Tony, enjoy all the parties. Enjoy the fun, and
I've got two young kids at home. The parties are behind me. I'm in bed by midnight, but I do go to the early park.
So you're going to take the kids with you. That's a fantastic trip. All right. Okay. Well, enjoy yourself, and we'll definitely be in touch to bring you on some other times as well. But I appreciate you calling.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
I take care, Tony. Okay. Bye bye. You're listening to Total Education Spotlight Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Spotlight Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Well, I'm excited about this guest because I have no idea about this professional sport. So he is, I guess, the quintessential person to interview. Big-time professional drag racer, BMW motorcycles, Dominic Anderson. Dominic, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you and kind of educate us in a way of specifically how you got involved in this sport, because being an African American, I don't think there are a ton of people in this sport that are African American, are there?
Well, as far as professional life, no, it's not a huge number of African Americans in this sport, you know, taking it on professionally. But I began, of course, definitely from racing off the street, which right now to this day I'm encouraging. And going amongst, you know, different groups trying to promote people to not race on the street. But it began with me. I was probably in 2004. I was aboard Suzuki at the time. And I know friends and family, they were just tired of me wrecking and hurting myself. You know, they knew a time was going to come where it was going to get to the point that I was either going to fall and injure some other folks, or, you know, injure myself to the point that it was going to be a loss. So, I don't know, it just took me to the point that they wanted to introduce me to a sport, drag racing, more professional series that I can go out here and entertain crowds. So, I got my first look at it around 2004, 2005, and I don't know, I felt extremely fast in 2008. I entered the professional series, AMA Drag Life, and history just been going from there. Lately, shortly after, I was introduced to BMW, and they definitely took a huge chance with me by their introduction of their latest and most powerful bike out there, you know, the S1000RR. And again, history's just been going from then.
So, Dominic, how long have you been into bikes? All your life?
Yeah, I really began. I got into bikes, I would say, about 10 years now. You know, my first bike was a 1996 Suzuki Strad 750. I bought it from a friend of mine, and, of course, you know, when you're buying, especially when you're not up to date with motorcycles, and it's your first time, they were telling me that it had all the bells and whistles, it was jetted out, and you could do whatever you want with it, but in actuality, it was just a motorcycle that had a rusted chain and it needed some serious work done to it. But, you know, I made do with it and I had fun. But I would say I have about 8 to 10 years on it, you know, give or take, from riding on the street and learning to drag racing professionally, taking this on part-time, full-time.
Would you say you had an athletic background before then, before drag racing and racing motorcycles?
Yeah, no, out before. I never, ever intended on taking this on, you know, professionally or even getting involved with motorcycling. I mean, straight out of high school, you know, my parents were serving me, attending colleges, you know, for my life. So I got my degree in computer science, and that's really all it did for me. That's all I wanted to do was just make my parents happy, make my family happy, and, you know, be successful, have a successful life. But, you know, when you're 18, 19 years old, it's, well, I want to have the flashiest wheels on a car and the loudest stereo. And, you know, when that gets played out, you know, you're looking for the next biggest thing to me. And that was motorcycling. I saw it, and it was like, hey, I want to learn as much as I can. And just so happened, I got involved with the correct people who knew a lot about motorcycles, and we rocked away from there. Once I was introduced to it, I was hooked. Like, I needed to know more. I wanted to know more. I wanted to go faster. I wanted to learn tricks. And, I mean, that's pretty much, I think that's how it goes, really, when any individual purchases a motorcycle. You know, they want to learn more about it. They want to do more about it. You know, either if they're not hanging around people who are influencing them to do dangerous stuff, then they're going to learn it, you know. Overall, eventually they're going to learn how to control that bike, pretty much.
So, Dominic, when you were in high school, were you a daredevil at all? Were you crazy, doing crazy stuff when you were in high school?
Man, if my parents were here, they would definitely say yes. I think I'm just your normal kid. You know, I played basketball, played football. I was pretty good in football. My father was too, and my uncles were too. So I was hoping that I was going to get a scholarship or whatnot in basketball or football, but I don't think I tried. I didn't apply as much as I should have. You know, again, 11th, 12th grade, hang around your friends. Not taking life serious, I mean. Just going out here. But no, as far as Daredevil, I think the only thing I've done Daredevil, especially back then, was telling a lie to my mom and definitely knowing that, you know, it's going to be you're going to catch hell by the time you come on back.
So you were athletic in sports. So, because again, no one can ride a motorcycle like you can unless you're an athlete. And that's one thing that people have to understand. You know, you see a lot of the extreme sports people as well that are not even motorcycles and the crazy stunts they do. They're very athletic people, aren't they, Dominic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we actually just witnessed, because, again, I'm here at the Jacob Dudley Center in New York City for the IMS show. And a good friend and ambassador for BMW, as well as with me, Cliff and Neil, they just did a show for XTL, and they were out there performing, doing stunts, stendos. I mean, that kid has been doing it for like 15, 20 years. I call him a kid, but I call everybody a kid. He's a little bit older than me. But, yeah, he works out. You got to have a body and whatnot. You have to train for this kind of stuff. I mean, as far as with drag racing, the good thing about drag racing, anybody can get in it. But to become a professional or a perfecter, of course, it's going to take a lot more than just you hopping on the bike and going for a ride, if you know how to ride, you know.
So once you saw that this is your gift, you just went with it. You said, man, did you study tapes and stuff? Or, you know, once you saw you were a natural athlete for this, because I'm sure some people probably drag raced when they were like 10 years old that you compete with every day. So what would you say? What kind of, how did you kind of become a student of the game so you were successful at it?
I think when I knew that I wanted to take this on seriously, it was, well, I guess you could say because of the money I invested in it too, but money and time. But I think it was just the fact that, you know, I had people in my corner who encouraged me and told me that I'm just as good as the professionals, like Brittany Depp, and, you know, and I said, you know what, I'm just as good as him. What makes it any different, you know? So with that being said, he kind of motivated me because he set the bar pretty high, you know, first African-American professional to be factory sponsored and supported by, you know, a big manufacturer. So he kind of, to me, he kind of changed the way and was that motivation for me. I saw the attention and spotlight that he had, and the fact that, of course, the dude is seriously fast and very consistent. I just said to to myself that, you know, I can be that. And to this day, we still compete, and even though he wins a lot, and I win a lot, you know, we're the best of friends. He gives me great advice when I need it. But that's pretty much where it started. Like, and I would say probably roughly around 2008, 2009, that's when I knew that I really wanted to take this on seriously and just have a deal with it. And I think what really sealed the deal was when BMW actually launched their first sport bike, the S1000, into an economy that at the time was its worth. I just seen that as an opportunity to, you know, promote myself, advice, and just have a good time with it. So we just went with it.
Well, absolutely, Dominic. And let me kind of understand this in more ways. How do you prepare for a race? What do you do in preparation? Is it more about maintaining your body to be in the best shape, practicing a lot? What would you say prepares you for a race?
Yeah, what prepares me for a race is pretty much, so like the race, our race series is broken down by different classes, and whatever class you're in, it usually has rules. So let's just say, for example, one of the classes that I race in is Pro D8, and it has a set of rules, you know, depending on your bike, that breaks down the rider. Then you have other classes like Real Street that it breaks it down by rider and actual the bike. So it also goes along with your weight. But what I was getting at is that with my weight, and I come in around 140-ish, to maintain that diet and that weight, you know, I'm always eating something healthy. I mean, every now and then I slip up and take one of the energy drinks because, I mean, my life is like a nonstop. I'm always on the go and always trying to come up with something new and entertaining for not just me, but my fans and followers. But I try to maintain a great diet. I usually eat a lot of cantaloupe and bananas, and I'm constantly drinking H2O. I mean, always, always, always. And I have a personal trainer. He comes to the house. We do like 30 minutes or an hour workouts, 5-mile runs first thing in the morning, and usually if my body is up to it in the evening as well. But that's pretty much how I really get prepped, you know, before a race. And once we get to the racetrack, we usually get there probably about 2 days prior to the actual event. I have a bicycle that I would go around riding on. I'm constantly training before I even come to the track, so we know that the bike is always ready for rock and roll. But yeah, while I'm at the track, I have a little bicycle that I purchased from Walmart, and I just go out there and I constantly make sure that my legs are great shape, my abs are in great shape, and you know, my body is loose, so I stretch and I clear my head and I'm ready to rock and roll.
So, Dominic, are you shocked once BMW started backing you and you saw the fame that developed? You probably thought when you first got in the sport that it wouldn't be this thing where you're just known in this community so well, like a rock star in ways. You never thought of that, did you?
No. I would say it hit me far after I saw possibly my name and whatnot, and my name, my brand, when I saw it in the magazines, a national publicized magazine, that's when it really registered to me that, you know, I'm becoming the face, a face of not just this sport, but, you know, this with BMW. And I just knew that, you know, okay, well, since we got the spotlight on it, let's go on and rock with it. Let's continue with it going. Let's see how far we can go with it. But I never intended on it, you know, going this far. I never intended to be a rock star. I just really wanted to go on with it to have some fun. But I'm taking full advantage of it.
So, Dominic, right. What is your ultimate plan? What do you want to accomplish in the sport by the time you retire? What do you want to be able to do?
I really and truly, with this sport, it's not always about winning. And I tell people that all the time. You know, just go out here. As long as I'm having a good time and I'm doing the best that I can be, best that I can do, I'm going out here representing my sponsors, my family, this sport, my brand, then I'm very content with it. You know, a lot of people can't say that, hey, my 9-to-5 job is racing. for traveling the world, entertaining folks by racing. You know, so to me, that's a blessing by itself. But my overall goal now, I guess you could say for 2013, I want to help individuals, you know, who are doing illegal stuff, illegal racing, or illegal freestyling, whatnot, on the street. I want to take them off the street. I want to give them an opportunity to be a part of something, you know, something totally different. You know, as far as drag racing, people who do some drag racing on the street, I want to be able to guide them, let them know that, hey, there's an opportunity or a window that you can come on over here to a sport that's doing the same things you're doing and maybe possibly, you know, hopefully get paid for it or you have a bigger audience, you know, and you're in a safer environment. That's the biggest thing. Like, for 2013, I just really want to push safety.
That's
safety,
great.
Safety, safety.
Because, again, you know, Fast and Furious and all these different things, people think, hey, I could just do this. It doesn't matter on the street when everyone's asleep, you know, and illegally. And it's so dangerous. And so many people get hurt or injured or die or violence occurs. I think that you want to get the word out. Hey, you can make money in this. Let's go for it. You could get it. You could become famous. Don't do the illegal racing. So are you thinking of starting a foundation or charity involving that to try to or awareness? Or is that an ultimate thing you're trying to look to do?
Well, we're working toward that. We haven't came to a full circle with that, but we're working towards that. And ultimately, you know, if I can start a foundation, I mean, we've been working definitely with a lot of foundations, other foundations to help promote it. But me personally, I haven't began a foundation to put money towards or gather up money towards that. So, but hopefully one day by the end of the day, everybody who's listening, your whole fan base, they'll jump on board. They know that's a great idea. I want you to go forward with it. You know, I'll support you. And with that being said, I'll be the first to go ahead and say, yeah, let me go and start this website up now and promote it as much as we can, because I've just seen too many people out there dying, too many close friends get injured. You know, a lot of times it's not always the rider. You know, it's people who don't see the rider. And I think that if any way that I can help, whether it's closing it, bringing it to the attention of others, and just giving, you know, kids or individuals an opportunity to come out here and do it on a safer environment, then so forth, so be it, you know.
Exactly. Well, Dominic, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It was interesting to learn about this, and best of luck in 2013 and all your ventures, and I hope that you have a long career, especially with your sponsor, BMW, and continue success and enjoy the ride. It seems like a lot of fun, and that's kind of funny. Enjoy the ride. You are enjoying that ride, and I appreciate you calling, and good luck to you. And we're also you're welcome. Where can we find more information on you, Dominic, and learn more about you?
Y'all can follow me on my webpage. It's www.dominicanderson, that's DominicAnderson, with an .com. I definitely encourage you to check me out on Twitter. Stay up to date with me on Twitter and Instagram, and definitely Facebook. You can check me on Facebook. I'm always updating my the social network, so if you see me saying something crazy, that's me. You definitely don't... It's not going to be anybody else that's tweeting for me, so it's definitely me.
All right, well, thanks again for calling, man, and look forward to talking to you soon, okay? Take care.
Thanks, man.
All right, take care. All right, you're listening to the Total Education Celebrity Spotlight Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. What a fantastic show we had. Again, go to my website, totaltutor.net, to find out more information. Dominic Anderson, fantastic interview. I never learned anything about BMX, BMW, motorcycle bike riding. I was like, unbelievable. Drag racing, fantastic. And then Rex McGee, Pure Country. I never knew it was such a popular movie. I really want to check that out and watch the movie. George Strait's in it. Wow, what unbelievable guests. And last but not least, how I can land some Super Bowl tickets. That's going to be interesting. So again, go to my website, totaltutor.net. The Spotlight Show, you know, we put some celebrities on now. I mean, everything, even the celebrity show, we really find interesting education talk. But you can go to the website, TuttleTutor.net, and listen every day to the network. We provide such great information from the Q&A show to roundtable discussions to news. Oh, it's just a fantastic network. Website, TuttleTutor.net. Follow me, Total Tutor, on Twitter. Neil S. Haley, Facebook. Have a great week. Next week we'll talk more education talk on some of the network, but other places we will be on every day. And thank you. And if you want all the radio stations to pick up all the programming, call them. Flood them with emails. Flood them with text messages. Whatever you can do to get me on 7 days a week on all the networks. Have a great week. We'll talk again tomorrow. Good day, everyone.